I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. If you were a flight attendant back in the 1960s and even into the 70s, you had to be female, under 32, height between 5'2 and 5'9, weight between 105 and 135, no eyeglasses, no crooked teeth, and no children. One airline even required you to kiss the male passengers when they departed the plane. And to add insult to injury, airlines ran sexist and suggestive ads, including one with the tagline, "Fly Me," that invited harassment and abuse, especially when your uniform was hot pants and go-go boots. Our guest Nell McShane Wolfart recounts this history in her new book, The Great Stewardess Rebellion, about how these women fought for their rights and for respect. And it wasn't easy. They were up against a powerful industry, a reluctant and at times completely clueless Congress, and an enduring sexism about the role and place for women. She joins us on Radio Times to tell this extraordinary story with a focus on two women whose names you should know, Pat Gibb and Tommy Hutto Blake. Nell McShane Wolfart, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. We have a lot to talk about.
Hi, Marty. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you with us. You write in the introduction to your book that the 1960s, the airplane cabin in the 1960s was the most sexist workplace in America, and there was a lot of sexism on the ground. What made it the worst?
I think it was a particular requirements for appearance that made it so difficult. So, as you mentioned in your intro, the weight requirement, you know, the female flight attendants were required to get on a scale in operations, by the way, the operations lounge in the airport. So the scale was right in the middle of the room with managers and other airline personnel passing by all the time. They had to wear what we would call now pretty degrading uniforms, extremely short skirts. In one case at TWA, they wore uniforms made out of paper.
Yeah, I read that.
Yeah.
How is that possible?
It didn't last very long. Apparently, they spent most of their time trying to staple together the torn uniforms. They also had to have extremely strict hairdo requirements. They had to be cut in a certain style, wear very specific makeup and nail polish and shoes and luggage. And in addition to all the appearance requirements, there was the general harassment from the public and often the pilots, because they were treated essentially as flying Playboy bunnies.
They had to go to charm school, and as you write, one of the graduates, or perhaps he was in the charm school itself, talked about learning the gracious art of making people happy.
Yeah, making
you're chuckling,
people happy.
Right?
I am. Making people happy was really the primary requirement of a stewardess back in those days. And even as you, if you look at some of the airline ads from that time, it's all about how the stewardesses are smiling and taking individual care of every passenger, and also making a hard job look easy.
Was this a popular job, though, at that time? And we're talking about the 1960s.
It was an extremely popular job. I think the acceptance rate for a job at TWA in the 60s was 3%. And in one year, you had 1 million women applying for 10,000 jobs as stewardesses. It was portrayed really as extremely exclusive and aspirational, very glamorous. You'd be jet-setting around the world, staying in fancy hotels, living this really cosmopolitan lifestyle.
Was that the truth, though? Was that the reality?
For some people, it was the truth, but that was really true for the international airlines like Pan Am and TWA, neither of which are still around. But those airlines, you could sort of live an upscale, glamorous lifestyle, at least when you were traveling. You know, you weren't staying at the airport Marriott, you were staying at a much nicer hotel, you were spending your days off by the pool, you were, you know, shopping in Paris. But for the people in my book, they mostly worked at the domestic airlines like American Airlines, and that was much more like, you know, flying back and forth between New York City and Syracuse 8 times a day.
You profile a couple of women in this book, including a woman named Pat Gibb. Why did she want to become a stewardess?
Pat Gibb was a 19-year-old from Springfield, Missouri, and she was basically looking for what so many other women were looking for at that time, an escape. And the jobs available to them were fairly limited. You could be a teacher, you could be a nurse, maybe you could be someone's secretary, but she was looking for a way to, you know, leave her family behind and travel the world, and this seemed to her like the perfect way to do it.
And what did it take for her to get accepted?
She had to, first of all, she had to lose weight.
How much?
She was about 10 pounds too heavy for the job, for her height, for the height requirement at the time. And she also had a small gap between two of her front teeth. So when she went for her first interview, the man looked her up and down, sort of checked her face to make sure she had clear skin and her teeth, and looked at her hands to make sure she didn't have any scars, and, you know, made her walk to and fro across the room while he examined her body. And he told her that she could be a flight attendant if she could do something about the gap between her two front teeth. So she went to the dentist, and she did.
You also write that she and other were calling them stewardesses because they weren't called flight attendants back then, but the other stewardesses had to buy their own uniforms to the cost of something like $650. And that was clearly a lot. It's a lot of money today, but a really lot of money back then.
Yeah, that was something that was eventually negotiated at the bargaining table, and the companies now pay for the uniforms, at least at some airlines. But yeah, it was a huge expense, and that was one of the sort of appearance requirements they had to fulfill. The uniforms had to be perfectly ironed, perfectly pressed. You couldn't spill anything on one. You had to really look the part.
And you had to wear white gloves, and at one point Pat got suspended because of some glove issue.
This was exactly how strict the requirements were. She was on a bus, this was in the early 1960s, on an airline employee bus going to the airport, and she was wearing her uniform because she was about to go on a flight, and it was a sweltering, sweltering day in Texas, and she took off her white gloves on the bus for a few minutes, surrounded only by other airline employees. But she was served a disciplinary infraction for that because it was mandated that stewardesses appear in public in uniform, and it must be perfect at all times.
At all times. How much, and we'll be talking about the problem of alcohol currently, but how much was that a problem for stewardesses back in the 1960s when you add the uniforms to what they were wearing and also these very provocative ads about who stewardesses were supposed to be?
On domestic flights of the 1960s, there was less alcohol on board, actually, than there is now. You were offered coffee, tea, or milk on most flights. But it was in the 1970s when the planes got bigger and they started to add more what I would call gimmicks to attract passengers that alcohol became more of a problem. On some of the bigger planes, they would put a cocktail lounge on, up a spiral staircase. And initially, they hired a bartender to mix drinks for the passengers. And then they decided to get rid of the bartender. Passengers could just help themselves, and they ended up falling down the spiral staircase fairly often, and they would drop lit cigarettes, between the airplane seats. Jeez. And on one flight, on one airline rather, they got rid of a number of rows of seats in economy, and they put in a piano bar. So there was a stand-up bar for drinking, and there was a piano at which any passenger could go and start playing music and singing along if they wanted to.
Yeah, the good old days. You mentioned coffee, tea, or milk, and I frankly remember a different kind of tagline associated with stewardesses, coffee, tea, or me.
Coffee, Tea, or Me was a series of books that came out, I think, in the late 60s. They were supposedly written by a stewardess who was living a very promiscuous lifestyle, a man in every airport, traveling all around the world. They were very titillating books. It turned out they weren't written by a stewardess at all. They were written by a man, and they were just really well marketed.
And called Coffee, Tea, or Me. I do want to play an ad. Now, this is from 1974. This is National Airline, and they had a series of what they call Fly Me commercials. In this commercial, obviously people can't see it because we're on the radio, a woman named Judy, she's a very attractive woman, drives to the beach, does a kind of a strip tease as she gets out of her clothing into her bikini, and then she runs into the ocean. Let's give it a listen.
Everything you've heard about us Miami girls is true. We're always on the move. I'm Judy, and I was born to fly. Fly me to Houston. National has non-stop DC-10s every day. Or fly me to New Orleans on the only DC-10s. You can fly me morning, afternoon, or night. Just say when. I'm Judy, and I was born to fly. Fly me.
Fly Judy. Fly National.
So what do we make of that ad?
That's just the tip of the iceberg, Marty. There are so many ads from the 70s that really have to be seen to be believed. Or you can look in my book. But the way that they portrayed the stewardesses as really sex objects, like nothing but sex objects. It's pervasive. Every airline was doing it. And not only did the airlines put them in these ads and try to sell tickets to passengers, but combine that with these ever-shrinking uniforms, and you really had a prime setup for sexual harassment 30,000 feet in the air.
Well, I'm looking at one of the ads in your book for Braniff Airlines. It's called Introducing the Air Strip. Now, what's happening here?
The airstrip was really the first of these really provocative ads, and it basically is a description of how the stewardesses on your flight they'll enter the plane looking a certain way, wearing a coat and a dress and stockings, and as the flight progresses, they will gradually take off one piece of clothing and then take off another piece of clothing, and by the end of the flight, they'll be wearing a lot less than they started. And the airstrip really was sort of setting the pace for some of these more outrageous ads.
In fact, you say that Continental had an ad. I guess this is a tagline. We really move our tail for you. I mean, talk about subtlety, correct?
No one would ever accuse these airlines of being subtle.
But the message was, come on our air. I guess message targeted largely to men, correct?
Male business travelers were absolutely the target market, and that's probably still true today.
And the idea is that you'll come on, you'll see an attractive woman, she's not going to be married, which I assume is significant. She'll be young, and she'll be attractive, and she might be interested in you. I mean, that seems to be the message there.
Absolutely. Every airline ad is a young, very young, smiling, conventionally attractive woman sort of straightening the tie of a much older male passenger or maybe bringing him a drink. She's always smiling. He's often not smiling. Yeah, absolutely. The idea was that these women are on the plane just to take care of you and stroke your ego and very little else.
And at charm school, did stewardesses then learn the kind of stewardess smile that was necessary?
Oh, absolutely. Not only did you learn how to put on makeup and paint your nails and, present yourself in the right way, but you made sure you learned how to smile and walk and do all sorts of other things correctly.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation with our guest, Nell McShane Wolfhart. She's a journalist, author of this new book called The Great Stewardess Rebellion, How Women Launched a Workplace Revolution at 30,000 Feet. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break, and we want to hear from you. If you were a quote-unquote stewardess or back then, or perhaps a flight attendant now, we do want to hear from you in particular. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We also want to hear from anybody else with an opinion about what we're talking about. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking about the good old days, the 1960s, even into the 1970s, when female flight attendants called stewardesses had to meet strict requirements about appearance. Our guest is Nell McShane Wolfhart, who recounts how women fought back against these requirements and restrictions. And again, her book is titled The Great Stewardess Rebellion. Let me play another clip from another commercial, and this is an Eastern Airline commercial. It's from 1967, and it's titled Losers.
She's awkward. Not very friendly. But she's too young. She bites nails. She wears glasses. Honey, no, the other. She's married. Well,
Eastern presents The Losers.
Immature.
19 out of 20 girls we see never get to be an Eastern Airlines stewardess. They're probably good enough to get a job anywhere they want. But at Eastern, we're very choosy about whom we let serve you on a plane. It may make our job a lot harder, but it makes your flying a lot easier. We want everyone to fly.
Oh, the girl with the glasses. Honey, wait, if you...
I've heard that several times. You want to respond to that?
That's one of my favorites.
I bet.
I feel like there's a lot to unpack here. But yeah, the idea of a parade of girls passing by, being rejected for all sorts of reasons, like being married or wearing glasses, is really, really a great reflection of the attitude of the airline at that time. And I think there's just as the cachet of becoming a stewardess was really just amped up by these ads. Like, those ads didn't just appeal to passengers who believed that they were getting served by the most exclusive and, you know, well-trained women in the world. They also appealed to women who were looking to become a stewardess. It was really, really an aspirational job.
We mentioned Pat Gibbs early on, who became a stewardess, and there is a picture that you include in your book of her being kissed by a passenger. This is the mid-1970s, and it was an airline that required the stewardesses to give the departing male passengers a kiss. And this is he's just like a total lock on her lips there.
Amazingly, this was something that happened at more than one airline.
Wow.
At American Airlines, when they had flights to Hawaii, the stewardesses were supposed to put a lei around the neck of the passenger and kiss them. And at Continental Airlines, for a while, the stewardesses were required to kiss every departing male passenger on the cheek as he left the airplane.
But clearly she's being kissed straight on the mouth there. And she does not, I mean, just looking at her body language, she does not look comfortable.
Yeah, men would just turn their heads all the time and try and catch the women on the lips. Yeah, it was not a great situation.
Here's an email from Elizabeth. She says, it's offensive how much you are laughing during this interview. It's disgusting how women were treated, and that flows to how women are treated today. This is a serious topic. And Elizabeth, I hope you're not clearly you're going away with the impression that we're laughing about this. We're clearly not. And the book is a serious book with, I guess the laughter is just how unbelievably sort of out of another century this is, and clearly it was.
Absolutely, Elizabeth. It's funny in retrospect because it's so shocking. Really, the laughter is a defense mechanism. You know, if you don't laugh, you cry.
So what was the turning point then when it came to stewardesses, to these female flight attendants? Because they did organize and made incredible changes when it came to what it is to be a flight attendant.
Stewardesses have actually been organized since the invention of the stewardess. Almost all stewardesses have belonged to a union since the 1930s. And as I note in my book, there was a big shift in the 1970s when a lot of these women left organized labor, really, left the Transport Workers Union, and they headed out and they formed their own women-led unions. And I would say the spark behind that was a couple of things. They were battling not only with the executives at the airlines to try and get better working conditions and you know, equal pay and things like single rooms on layovers, but they also had to battle the male leadership of the Transport Workers Union. You know, those men were supposed to be advocating for the stewardesses, but in reality, they treated them a little more like mascots of the labor movement.
And they started something, the Stewardesses for Women's Rights. So this was in reaction to the TWU or as a part of the TWU?
This actually was separate from union activity. Stewardesses for Women's Rights was started in 1972, and it has the most fabulously 70s name, I think, of any organization ever. I just adore it. And this was a group of stewardesses from airlines all across the country who were meeting up to figure out ways that they could call attention to the working conditions of the stewardess, you know, to bring the media to it, to get more eyes on the fact that they weren't being treated fairly and that they were really being treated like sex objects. it was sparked in part by the feminist movement. And in fact, Gloria Steinem, who has been a huge supporter of the stewardesses, she was at many of their meetings and conventions.
Well, and all this was going on as the women's movement was gaining steam and gaining power.
Yeah, I think it was the contrast between the freedoms that women were getting, you know, in the outside world. And they could get their own credit cards and buy houses, and there was just more sexual liberation. And then the fact that the stewardesses entered kind of a time warp when they stepped into the airplane cabin, having to wear a girdle and high heels, and you know, call all the passengers Mr. So and So, while the passengers addressed them by their first name. So I think it was that contrast that really forced a lot of change.
Here's a question from Margaret: what racial ethnic guidelines were in effect for qualifications to become a stewardess?
Such a great question.
Yeah.
Stewardesses were almost always white well into the 60s. And in fact, I interviewed Joan Dorsey, who was American Airlines' first black flight attendant, and she started in the 60s. But she was one of the very few. And even now, you can see that there's not like a ton of racial diversity in the airlines.
And is that because of these really draconian appearance requirements, things like hair?
Some of them were absolutely targeted at women of color and women, you know, afros or natural hair was not allowed on the airplane. One flight attendant in the 60s was fired for having an afro. Mm-hmm. When the women went to what they called the Charm Farm, which was stewardess training school, you know, they had to wear, you know, makeup that was provided by the school or pantyhose provided by the school. And if you weren't white, those things did not match your skin tone. In fact, they looked completely ridiculous. And of course, the stylists at the Charm Farm didn't know how to do anything with hair that wasn't like white hair. So yeah, there were a lot of obstacles put in the way.
And what happened when a stewardess got pregnant?
She would be fired immediately.
And what if she got married?
Also fired. These things were changed gradually through lawsuits and hearings and bargaining throughout the 60s and into the 70s. But it took like a superhuman effort to overturn any single one of those, including that women would be fired when they turned 32, or at some airlines, 33. And I think it won 35.
And one was 35. Let me get Diane from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Diane, go ahead. You're on the air. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I was just laughing because I graduated from high school in 62, and I definitely wanted to be a stewardess, and I applied, and I wasn't accepted because I wore glasses. Okay, well, then I got contact lenses. And I went back, and they said, well, you can't be a stewardess. You're wearing contact lenses. And they might pop out when you were helping somebody in an emergency.
Wow.
So I never did get to fly in that capacity, anyway.
In that capacity. Were you disappointed, yeah. Diane?
Well, yeah, I was. I was always interested in flight. My father had been a pilot, and of course, it was an attractive thing for a young teenager to do at that time. And I was disappointed, but I got over it.
Well, I do appreciate your call. Nell, anything you want to say back to Diane?
Well, I'm sorry you didn't get your chance, Diane.
Okay.
Thanks, Diane. Thanks for calling into Radio
Thank
Times.
You.
Sure. Bye-bye. And you can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we're talking with Nell McShane Wolfhart. She's got a new book. It's called The Great Stewardess Rebellion, How Women Launched a Workplace Revolution at 30,000 Feet. Here's a tweet from Abby. My mother trained to be a licensed practical nurse in the late 1950s. She too was subject to beauty standards like the one described for stewardesses. She was ordered to lose weight, wear makeup in a particular way, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, Abby, we're talking, yes, about stewardesses, but this is a certain time and place.
That is absolutely horrifying, frankly. That is really atrocious, almost worse than what the stewardesses went through. But I will actually point out that up until the middle of the century, flight attendants were required to be nurses, that until I think really the jet age, when flying became safer and less turbulent and less filled with engine fumes, every stewardess had to be a qualified nurse.
Wow. Let me read something that Harry Reasoner said. He was, very famous evening news anchor, and he was the host of ABC News program called The Reasoner Report. And this is a quote here. "I don't want a sex object in a narrow aisle," obviously talking about stewardesses, "but I don't want a surly union member either. I want someone youthful and illusory who looks like she thought flying was fun, even if she knows more about emergency evacuation of airplanes than I would like to think about." So this view of women as stewardesses, as flight attendants, was so pervasive.
It was extremely pervasive, and that quote still makes me angry 50 years later. it was something that was just encouraged by the airlines. Like, it was more profitable for them to portray the stewardesses as flying sex objects rather than as what they really were, which was safety professionals. And there's a number of examples in my book of men just completely disregarding the women when they were in the capacity of a safety professional. A flight attendant might tell a passenger to put on a seatbelt, and he'd say, "Oh, I've been flying since before you were born." Mm-hmm. Or she's trying to conduct an emergency evacuation wearing one of the more egregious American Airlines uniforms, which was a sort of Wild West themed uniform, a tartan skirt, a tartan vest, and a raccoon skin hat.
I missed that growing up. He also quoted someone else who said, and this is about stewardesses, "They should remain patches of color in the business of flying. They should be there for a few years and then, like the clouds outside the windows, be replaced with soft, fluffy new ones," just to add insult to injury.
That was one of the things that the Stewardesses for Women's Rights group got extremely up in arms about, and they wrote letters and they had marches, and that was one lesson that they told me they learned from Gloria Steinem, which was to throw the insult, a sexist insult, back in someone's face, turn it back on them. So they wrote a letter to Harry Reasoner telling him that, you know, maybe he should be replaced by a much younger anchor who didn't have gray hair.
Well, it's interesting. We played that Go Fly Me ad, and the organizers came up with a response to that, which was Go Fly Yourself.
Go Fly Yourself was a tentative title for the book for a while, because I thought it was so, fun and funny, and also, it really made me mad. When the flight attendants started to protest the Fly Me ads, they would march outside the New York office of the ad agency that invented the whole Fly Me, I'm Cheryl, Fly Me, I'm Donna campaign. And in a very misguided move, the owner of the agency, his name was Bill, he came out to the marchers who were holding these picket signs that said, "Go fly yourself," and he handed out bouquets of roses to them. Mm. And so they went away and they made new signs that said, "I'm Bill, fire me." Oh, I thought that was pretty good.
Well, another one was a headline said, "Think of her as your mother." This, of course, is about a stewardess. "She only wants what's best for you, a cool drink, a good dinner, a soft pillow, and a warm blanket. This is not just maternal instinct, the result of the longest stewardess training in the history." And then Pat, who we mentioned earlier, cut the ad out of a magazine, plastered a few words above it, "Would you fire your mother at 32. So they were very clever at using these ads against both the ad agencies, I guess, but also against the airlines.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that they were very good at was getting press attention, and those signs were part of it. You know, the press in the 70s was really drawn to the idea of angry stewardesses. And of course, that was partly because, you know, the stewardesses had this public image of being these sex objects. So in some ways, it helped them out.
And how did Congress respond to them? Because there were hearings and stewardesses did go to testify. What was the response?
Yeah, the hearings were mostly about the age limit. Congress was addressing the idea of age discrimination and at what age discrimination laws should go into effect. But whenever the stewardesses would turn up at Congress to testify for these hearings, they were mostly laughed at and also gawked at. You know, a senator would ask them to stand up so we can view the scale of the problem, essentially just like complimenting their appearances, talking basically about how it was important for a stewardess to be attractive, and they never passed any law that would protect stewardesses from being fired at 32.
And what about the EEOC and other, you know, civil rights groups and acts? Did that in any way protect stewardesses?
They didn't start out protecting stewardesses. In fact, stewardesses were some of the first people to lodge complaints with the EEOC because their working conditions were so outrageous. And for years, the EEOC pretty much ignored them because, you know, their job was mostly to deal with race. That's how they understood it. That's how it was understood by everyone, that the EEOC was there to work on racial discrimination in employment, not sex discrimination. But stewardess complaints kept piling up, and finally a lawyer, the first women lawyer in the EEOC General Counsel's office, Sonia Pressman, she got angry enough about it that she took this to the National Organization for Women, and they started writing angry letters, and the EEOC eventually, finally, after this, you know, public shaming, began to take action.
And this was Sonia Pressman who, as you mentioned, worked for the EEOC and almost acted as a spy, right, about what was actually going on there.
Yeah, Sonia would go to work at the EEOC all day, go to meetings where, you know, the commissioners would discuss the cases they were going to take on, which were all race cases, and they would ignore all the sex discrimination cases lodged by the stewardesses. And then at night, she would take a bus across D.C. and go meet with the legal committee of the National Organization for Women and tell them everything that had been going on, divulging all this information, and then the legal committee would take action. But somehow no one ever thought to ask where they got all their inside information.
Oh, really? So that was a mystery until now?
I'm sure Sonia's told some other people about it, but yes, until now.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about a new book. It's called The Great Stewardess Rebellion, How Women Launched a Workplace Revolution at 30,000 Feet. And the author is Nell McShane Wolfhart, who is telling us about what it was like to work as a stewardess back in the 1960s, even into the 1970s. And we have a current flight attendant waiting to join our conversation. You can as well email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and if you're just joining us, let me tell you what we're talking about. If you were a flight attendant back in the 1960s, you had to be female, under 32, height between 5'2 and 5'9, weight between 105 and 135, and childless. Some airlines required you to kiss the male passengers when they deplaned. We've been talking with Nell McShane Wolfhart about her new book. It's called The Great Stewardess Rebellion, How Female Flight Attendants Fought Back Against the Airline Industry and Against the Government for Rights and Respect. Joining us now is Krista Gifford. She's been a flight attendant for 10 years, works for Allegiant Airlines, and is president of Transport Workers Union Local 557. And Krista Gifford, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So what do you enjoy about being a flight attendant?
I think that our travel benefits are amazing. I really think that's why a lot of people get into this industry and then they realize, oh, this is more about being a safety professional. But definitely I've been able to take some trips that I probably wouldn't have been able to take without having this as my career.
And what has it been like to be a flight attendant during the pandemic over the last 2 years when there was a mask mandate? What was that like for you and other flight attendants?
Well, it completely changed our job because we had to deal with something that we never had to deal with before. And it was very difficult. It made a lot of flight attendants leave the industry. And it was just something that we never thought that we would have to deal with. And it just completely changed our jobs.
We've all seen videos of passengers becoming unruly, sometimes even violent. Did you have to deal with those kinds of problems with the mask mandate?
I did have some people on my plane. It was more verbal, not physical, but I do have a flight attendant that's based in Las Vegas with me who was assaulted for simply doing his job,
wow,
asking somebody to wear a mask, and she lashed out on him and kicked him, and he was injured. And that's really the reality of what we're dealing with now, and it's crazy.
It sure is. I mean, was that a passenger, was she arrested?
She was.
She was.
Yes. She actually had some issues when she went through TSA, and they kind of just let her go because they don't do any sort of like background check on her at TSA. Right. So, and then, you know, we found that out after the fact that she had other issues, and there was also other charges against her. So, yes, she was arrested.
Now, the mask mandate has been lifted. Has that made your job easier?
I think it has in certain aspects. I don't think that's making the unruly passengers completely disappear, because that was a problem that was going on far before the mask mandate. It's just something that has, you know, been publicized more now that, you know, the mask was a thing. But people are definitely happier now that there is no mask requirement. And it's starting to, I guess, slowly get back to how it used to be.
Do you feel safe? Do you wear a mask? Do you feel protected? We're not through the pandemic. It's not as bad as it was before, but, you know, it's not over yet.
Right. I wear a mask on and off on the plane. I think when I'm in the cabin with 100 passengers, I feel more comfortable with it on.
Yeah.
Because I do have that in the back of my mind, you know, I could get sick and I could make my coworker sick. And we already have a staffing shortage, just like every other airline right now. And that it could really do some harm if everybody was to get sick again.
Yeah, I hope you do stay safe. You mentioned unruly passengers, and I do want to get our guest, Nell McShane Wolfhard, back in on the conversation. You said unruly passengers were a problem even before the pandemic. Is that related to alcohol, the fact that people can drink so much, or either in the airport or once they get on the plane?
Yeah, I would say alcohol definitely plays a factor in that. You know, especially being a flight attendant based in Las Vegas, people want to get on the plane and just get intoxicated, or they want to do it before they get on the plane. And, you know, they just do a pretty good job of covering it up until we take off. And so, yeah, I would say a majority of the issues that we've had before the pandemic were a result of intoxication.
Neil, you mentioned this was also true in more into the 60s, into the 70s, when airlines really began selling cocktails and even having bars and bartenders on airplanes. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think that it's the combination of alcohol and the general disrespect that for flight attendants that the general public has, even these days, is a kind of a lethal combination. And I know that Sarah Nelson, who's the current president of the Association of Flight Attendants and a very important labor leader at the moment, she's called for extending the ban on alcohol for at least another while, just to protect flight attendants.
Do you like that idea, Krista?
Well, I mean, yes, I do. Our airline hasn't done that. We served alcohol all throughout the pandemic. So I guess we were a little bit different than some of the other airlines. But yeah, I do think that would keep flight attendants safer if people weren't drinking so much.
Sure. And do you feel, Nell mentioned the word respect. Do you feel as a flight attendant, you are by and large respected by the passengers?
I would say for the most part we are. I think people are starting to realize that our job isn't just to serve passengers snacks and drinks, that it's far more than that. Of course, we're always going to have a few people on the plane who just feel like they are going to do whatever they want to do. But yeah, for the most part, I think people realize that we're there for their safety.
Well, in fact, Neil, you write in your book that after September 11th, there was a kind of rethinking about the role, the responsibility of flight attendants.
Yeah, and after 9/11, flight attendants were actually became licensed safety professionals. Congress decided that they would actually license them as safety professionals, which is something that activists had been lobbying for actual decades up to that point. But there was definitely a change and a different recognition of what flight attendants were there for post 9/11.
Krista, I was reading about Delta apparently will now pay cabin crew during boarding, not when passengers are seated and the doors are shut, when typically that's when the pay starts. And I was shocked to read that. Can you clarify that? So that when during a flight do you get paid as a flight attendant?
So we don't start getting paid until the plane pushes back from the gate. And I think a lot of people don't realize that that's a thing that we have to deal with. And we do a lot of work during the boarding process. Like, in fact, I think that's one of the hardest parts of our job. And so we only get paid a per diem during boarding, and our per diem is $2 an hour. So when we're delayed and we're sitting on the plane at the gate with passengers, you know, they say to us, "You guys must love this. You're getting paid for this." And I'm like, "Actually, we're getting $2. And it's like, people just don't understand it. And so when flight attendants saw that Delta was getting boarding pay, I think every flight attendant was really excited about that, because we do deserve to get it paid our hourly rate while we're on the ground. I know that Delta is not unionized, and I think that's part of the reason why they've been offered that. But it's a great benchmark for other airlines to strive to get the same thing, because we deserve that.
Well, and anyone that's boarded an airplane knows how complicated it is to get people on and off that airplane, Krista. I mean, that
really
in certain ways is the most complicated, at least, you know, from the outside. You've got people coming on and trying to shove their suitcases in the overhead bins and all those things.
Yes.
And you get $2 an hour for that.
Yes. Yeah, it is a difficult part of our day, for sure. I think some people, when they get on a plane, we always joke and say, people just lose their mind when they get on a plane. They don't know what to do. And so, you know, having to direct them to how do you put your luggage in the overhead bin and where is your seat and all of that, it can be very difficult sometimes.
Yeah, I can imagine. We have to say goodbye to you, but Neil, anything you want to say in response to what Krista's been talking about?
First of all, I'm laughing at people not knowing what they're doing when they get on the plane. I think that's hilarious. But also, just to remark on the payment for boarding at Delta, I think you can absolutely tie that to the union drive that's happening at Delta right now. The Association of Flight Attendants is trying to unionize the 24,000 flight attendants at Delta, which is going to be a very big moment in the labor movement, whether or not that happens. And it's also a good reminder that, you know, for people working without a union, that the company can give you things like paying you for boarding, but it can also take away those things. And the way that you keep those benefits and keep those rights that you've fought for is through your union.
Well, Krista Gifford, I really appreciate you joining us on Radio Times. Again, you've been a flight attendant for 10 years. She works for Allegiant Airlines and is president of Transport Workers Union Local 557. Krista Gifford, thanks so much, and stay safe up there, okay?
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Us as well. Let me ask you a quick question, Nell. Obviously, there are now male flight attendants along with female flight attendants. Did that change either the organizing or how flight attendants were looked at by the industry, by passengers, by government?
It made some change. There was, of course, a lot of homophobia, and the male flight attendants were kind of degraded in the same way that the female flight attendants had been degraded for so long. So in some ways, that kind of formed a bond between them when they were both in the cabin. And also the fact that the male flight attendants, you know, they weren't being weighed, they didn't have to wear nail polish or makeup, you know, they could even bring their own whatever luggage they wanted, while the female flight attendants could only bring, you know, the approved luggage. All those things were gradually toppled as the flight attendants realized that they could use men being on board to make all these changes in the cabin.
And no high heels, right? I mean, that eventually went away, right?
That eventually went away. Not necessarily at every airline, but for most airlines, that requirement went away.
And how many, do we know how many miles does a flight attendant walk during a typical domestic flight? Let's say that's 3 or 4 hours. Do we know?
I think they can walk up to 8 miles in one flight, which is pretty incredible if you think about having to do it in 3-inch heels.
Absolutely. Let me get Joan to join our conversation. And Joan joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Joan. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we have Joan? No. Oh, there we go. Hi, Joan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I was a flight attendant beginning in 1965 in December. And I went through until 1989, so I saw some of these changes. One of the things I wanted to point out was the weight requirement that we had. Back when I started, I was based in Los Angeles, and we had to drop 2 pounds a week if we were overweight. That's a lot. And nobody thought too much about the medical part of it at the time. And I know that pilots were given meals that were balanced along with our passengers, but we were given at every leg 2 bouillon cubes and 2 little packets of saltine crackers. And that was how we ate, no matter how long the flight was.
Oh,
unless
my God.
We were able to get off. Yes.
And Joan, and that was to keep the weight off, right?
Presumably, yes.
Or to starve you. Let me give
that. Salt and carbohydrates is pretty much what we got.
Salt and carbohydrates. Nell, any thoughts on that?
It reminds me of an incident in my book where Pat Gibbs is, you know, she gained a few pounds. She was over her maximum permitted weight, and the company doctor put her on methadrine, which the flight attendants called Black Mollies, but it was speed, and the company doctors would hand these out to flight attendants by the box full because it helped them lose weight. I mean, they didn't sleep, and it made them paranoid, but they did lose weight. And if there's anything more terrifying than the thought of an airplane full of flight attendants hopped up on speed, I'm not sure what it is.
Joan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Here's a comment from Marilyn. She says, I was a flight attendant from 78 to 88 for Pan Am, based out of JFK. We had weight checks, but to me, it was a wonderful life. It was a good job. The other options were limited. I could be a teacher or a nurse as an alternative. And I think we touched on this earlier, which is, and we heard from our current flight attendant, Krista Gifford, is that she enjoys her job. There are benefits.
It's certainly a great job in a lot of ways, not just the travel benefits, but also being able to arrange your schedule in the way that you want. A lot of flight attendants will fly for 2 weeks and then be home for 2 weeks, or they'll live in Australia and commute to Boston. There's a lot of advantages to being a flight attendant. And back in the 60s and 70s, for sure, there was, like, I think, a higher standard of treatment on layovers for flight attendants. So for sure, there was something that drew women to the job, no question.
And we're almost out of time here, but would it be fair to say that the no smoking on airplanes, that was pivotal in getting smoking out of the workplace?
That was actually the first federal smoking ban, was something that flight attendants lobbied for, and that was on airplanes. And yeah, that was like another landmark achievement that the stewardesses made.
Well, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times. I learned a lot both talking to you and also reading your book.
Thank you so much, Marty. That was really fun.
Fun for us as well, and also very instructive. That's Nell McShane Wolfhart. And we talked about her new book called The Great Stewardess Rebellion, How Women Launched a Workplace Revolution at 30,000 Feet. Well, thanks so much for joining us. And we do want to close things out with Frank Sinatra singing Come Fly With Me. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.
Come fly with me. Let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come on and fly with me. Let's fly away. Come fly with me. Let's float down to Peru. In Llama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you. Come on, fly with me. Let's take off in the blue. Once I get you up there, where the air is rarefied, we'll
we'll just glide starry-eyed. Once I get you up there, I'll be holding you so near. You may hear all the angels cheer, because we're together weather-wise.